Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, host Latara Smith of the KC Freedom Project talks with Joe Amrine and Reggie Griffin about the struggle to rebuild their lives with no compensation from the state or support from local organizations after their exonerations. Then, if the prison in Cameron is not locked down, we also hope to have Arian Neal, who is fighting for his freedom, talk about the Missouri Supreme Court ruling that set David Robinson free and what that ruling may mean for others fighting wrongful convictions. We will not be able to bring you our scheduled conversation with Stacy Pratt about a new effort she and others are working on to hold prosecutors accountable, but we will be taking your calls in the second half of the show. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here's Latara and her guest.
Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in this morning. This is Latara Smith of the KC Freedom Project, and I am here with my special guest, Mr. Reggie Griffin. We kind of have a shift of events this morning, some last-minute changes, but we still have an awesome show ahead for you guys. For those of you who do not know who Reggie Griffin is an individual who served multiple years within the Missouri Department of Corrections for a crime that he did not commit. I'm going to let him go into the specifics and in reference to his time and things like that here in just a few. But this is most definitely a topic that we want to touch base on this morning with the overturning of the recent overturning of the David Robinson case. So we're going to be going into quite a few things this morning. Mr. Griffin,
yes,
thank
ma'am.
You so much for coming on the show with me this morning. I appreciate having you here.
Thanks for having me, Ms. Smith. This topic that we are discussing this morning is one that I went through personally, okay? I served 31 years for a wrongful conviction, and my case was overturned by the Supreme Court, but the same issues that they overturned it on had went before the state courts on numerous occasions, and I would get erroneous rulings, and the judge would say things like, they don't have jurisdiction to rule on it.
Yes.
It's out of timing. The issue is procedurally barred. I came to the conclusion that one circuit judge does not like to overturn or oversee another's jurisdictional issue.
And do you think, and let's just verify something for the record. You did 31 years in prison, but you did some of those years on death row for the crime that you didn't commit. So can you specify the time for our listeners, how much time you did on death row?
I'm going to say that I did approximately, 10 years on death row.
Okay.
My case was overturned on the fact that the state used the aggravating circumstances of another person. It was not my conviction. It was another person with the same name as mine, and they used that as the aggravating circumstances to give me the death sentence.
Wow. And so, you know, with the recent overturning of the David Robinson case, it took David Robinson case, even, and for those of you who don't know, David Robinson's case was just overturned by the Supreme Court, and they have ordered his release here within the next 30 days from the date when the ruling came down, which was, I think, one day last week or week before.
Yes, ma'am.
So Mr. Robinson should be walking out of the Missouri Department of Corrections any day now. But the issue of, we've got some prosecutorial things going on that most definitely needs to be addressed, even like in David Robinson's case. Why did it, and I'm asking you this question, Mr. Griffin, why did it take so long for someone to right the wrong in Mr. Griffin's case? Why did it have to go all the way up that judicial ladder to the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to eventually say, hey, listen, let this guy out. This was wrong. His constitutional rights were violated. You know, why do you think it took him to have to go all the way up the Supreme Court? Do our local courts and prosecutors not have an obligation to address these issues when they're made known? Or like you said, you went through all of the different, you know, court hearings and you kept getting these erroneous decisions. What changed in your case, basically, from when you were going in through the lower courts? What changed from then versus when you got up into the Supreme Courts?
Okay, I'm going to tell you that the same issue that I had before the circuit court is the exact same issue that went before the Missouri Supreme Court.
But the circuit courts just would not overturn the case.
When I went, I had a hearing. I was being held in Cameron, so I had a hearing, evidentiary hearing, in DeKalb County, okay?
Yes, yes.
And when my case went before that judge, he said that he would rule on it within 30, 60, no more than 90 days. He didn't rule on it until maybe 8-9 months later, okay?
Okay.
And when he ruled on it, what he essentially did was he allowed the attorney general to write the opinion, and he signed it, okay?
Okay.
Now, it went before him. He heard the evidence. He heard all the witnesses. And I'm thinking that he's going to make his decision based on what he heard in open court in his courtroom.
Okay.
Not the case, okay? He looked over it, and being that I feel that the evidence was strong enough for him to overturn my case, I don't think that he would take the liberty to do it.
Okay.
And he, in turn, allowed the attorney general who was arguing the case against me to write the opinion. And he signed it and sent it, you know, a copy to me and a copy to my attorney. And so after that was done, we appealed the conviction, appealed the decision to the Court of Appeals in the Western District, which summary denied it, okay? I'm going to say it went before them, and within 10 days, they had denied it. And after that, you appeal it to the Missouri Supreme Court. And that can be tricky because when you appeal a decision from the Court of Appeals to the Missouri Supreme Court, they don't have to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to agree to hear it. And once they agree to hear it, then your case will be argued. But you could have valid issues and they could still say, well, we don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they decide not to hear it, you will pretty much be up the creek because you have no more appeals and no more avenues to pursue an appeal, okay? In my case, a state habeas was filed, a Rule 91, okay?
Yes.
Essentially, I had no more avenues to appeal to had they not agreed to.
Now, when you say a Rule 91, because I'm familiar with that, you're familiar with that, but our listeners are not familiar with that, so can you kind of what is a Rule 91 and where is it filed? Within what courts?
A Rule 91 is a state habeas corpus proceeding where you file it under, like, you have newly discovered evidence, and this is a vehicle which you will use to get the newly discovered evidence along with any other claims that you previously have been arguing.
Okay.
It's sort of like a last ditch effort.
So in order to file a state habeas Rule 91, a person would have to have what's like newly discovered evidence?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Because normally if you file something and it hasn't been brought up in the past, you would get a decision stating that you are what is called procedurally barred. And if you are procedurally barred, then they're saying that you didn't file this proceeding in a timely manner.
Okay. Okay. And so when you filed your Rule 91 with the same evidence, the same issues that end up going on to the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court overturned, What happened when you filed your Rule 91? It was denied, and then where did you go from there? And before we go any further, let me ask you this question. Who was your attorney? Were you, who was your attorney that represented you? Were you represented by the Innocence Project?
No, ma'am. I was represented by a guy by the name of Kent Gibson.
Okay, Mr. Gibson, yeah. Okay, okay.
He's an appeal attorney, okay?
Okay.
And he,
very familiar with him.
He came to see me, and he took my case, and he read over it. And I'm going to say maybe a month later, he came back to see me, and he said that I had some viable issues.
Yes, okay. Now, your case was out of what, St. Louis, right?
No, my case was out of Randolph County.
Randolph County. And mm-hmm. where is that at? Is that
in Mobley.
Mobley. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Randolph County.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but Mr. Gibson is an attorney here in
Kansas City.
So mm-hmm. he's still, okay, he didn't have any problem with taking it. That's
well,
good.
Well, you know, there are so many guys that need help. But one thing people have to understand is that it costs a great deal of money to fight one of these cases, okay? And there are a lot of people who are innocent but do not have what it takes to get the help they need.
Exactly. Which is the very reason, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is the very reason that a legitimate conviction integrity unit is so important to have within, you know, a county or a state. It's very important to have because, you know, individuals, you know, once you get convicted and you know, the judge slams that gavel down and you're sentenced to prison and off to DOC you go, at that point, and you get past the regular appeal part of everything, at that point, you're fighting what you call post-conviction relief.
Absolutely.
And
it is called, okay, once you've been convicted and you are sentenced and shipped off to prison, you're gonna have what is called a 2915 post-conviction remedy, okay?
Yes.
And if you don't file that 2915 proceeding in a timely manner, you are procedurally barred from that point on. It doesn't matter.
Now, is that what they're doing in the Ricky Kidd case? Because they said he was barred. I mean, there was some time span, something that he missed, that he filed outside of the timeline. Is that the case in Ricky Kidd?
That
do you know?
That is pretty much how they're going through his proceedings. But being that he has newly discovered evidence, then it should not be a problem for his case to be heard, okay? Because there are so many situations where evidence is withheld by the prosecutor's office or the police.
Yes.
They know of these things, and it's supposed to be their duty to bring this forward. But not all the time, because if they feel like I can obtain a conviction by putting this under the rug, it'll get done.
Oh, I've seen it. I know it gets done. Oh, I know. I very much, very well know that. And so, you know, and for you listeners that are just tuning in, Latara Smith of the KC Freedom Project, and today I am interviewing Reggie Griffin. Mr. Griffin served 31 years within the Missouri Department of Correction, with approximately 10 of those years on death row for a crime, a murder that he did not commit. So for those of you who were just tuning in, and we are discussing the issues around, you know, the process of one getting back in, you know, without getting back in court, you know, why is it, and this is the topic, why is it that an individual has to go all the way to the Supreme Courts before their case before it's looked at, before the wrongs are made right? It just doesn't seem right. It just doesn't make any sense.
But
do our prosecutors on a local level, okay, if there's newly discovered evidence, like you just mentioned, because that's what it takes to get back in on what you called
Rule 91. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for individuals that don't have that attorney that is representing them in that process, or that can prepare that motion for them, or whatever the case may be, going back to what I said before, That is why this is so important for us to have a conviction integrity unit, because a legitimate conviction integrity unit, because conviction integrity units do just what they do. It's just what it says, conviction integrity unit. They look at the integrity of that conviction. You know, they look at it. It's a team within a prosecutor's office that looks at this newly discovered evidence, investigates the newly discovered evidence, and prosecutors, you know, according to the rules of their conduct, they're supposed to look at newly discovered evidence, investigate it, and then make it known into the courts. And I see so many times, Mr. Griffin, that that does not happen, especially here in Jackson County, Missouri. Why? And you mentioned that could be because the circuit judges don't want to overturn the other, or whatever the case may be. But is there anything else more to that? Just besides our prosecutors just outright not doing and performing their ethical duties? What else do you think? What do you think is maybe an underlying cause of that?
Well, I'm going to tell you, you would not believe how many cases fall through the cracks because their agenda is to win. And I'm going to say that winning to them by any cause, okay, sure. They have more peoples to get out there and investigate because their funds are unlimited, okay? And they find things that will point to a person's innocence, and that is something that gets swept under the rug, okay? It may be years and years and years down the line that an independent investigation might uncover this, okay?
Okay.
And when that person uncovers this, it's been known to those people in high positions that, hey, this evidence existed, okay?
Right, right.
But had it not been found, then that person would spend the rest of their life in jail, or possibly it could be a death penalty case. That person could get executed. These people, they're in a position to make decisions. And once they cross that line and say, they believe, they feel, or they think this person is guilty, something can come across their desk to say, hey, this is the wrong guy. They do not want to admit that they have made a mistake.
Okay. And so you think basically that's what this all boils down to?
Oh, absolutely. I found out so many things that had went in my case that, you know, when my case was overturned, we essentially received discovery again.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been independent, secret investigations coming from Jeff City. Bear in mind, the attorney general handled my case, so that come from Jeff City. They sent their investigator out to find these witnesses who had testified against me, and those people told those investigators that, hey, we lied on that man. We never saw what happened in that incident. They essentially said, well, I'm going to tell you, I don't know who sent you to see me, but they know that I was lying before I even got on the stand because they told me to lie.
Right, right. So the authorities told the witnesses in your case to,
absolutely,
to tell
people
untruths.
From okay. The attorney general's office, okay?
And I hear that often in cases as well.
Well, it's sad that things like this happen because these people are the ones who have been sworn into office to uphold the law.
Exactly.
And here it is. Something come across their desk. They say a person is arrested in jail. Something can come across their desk to say, hey, you had the wrong guy. And they would turn a blind eye on that. They would sweep that under the rug. They would hide it. They would say they never saw it, when actually it came across their desk first.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, so I'm going to tell you that a lot of things in the judicial system is very unfair, and they fabricate cases against people. A lot of things are based on rush to judgment, and it could be a high-profile case, and a person could be wearing the same clothes that the perpetrator was wearing. They'll go around the corner, grab that person, and they will get on the news and say, we have our man. Well, technically, they don't have their man. They have a man, okay?
And that's not that. I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Griffin, because that's a point that I want to make, is this right here. Whenever we have the wrong person incarcerated for a crime, the assailant is still out, still free within our community to commit that same crime again.
Absolutely.
Okay. And let me ask you something. You said Kent Gibson was your attorney that represented you.
Yes, ma'am.
How long from the time that Kent Gibson came on your case to the day you walked out that penitentiary, a free man, how long did it take?
I'm going to say maybe 3 or 4 years.
3 or 4 years.
Yes, ma'am.
Why do you think it is when we see cases like, let's say, Rodney Lincoln, where, you know, they've been fighting for years to get him out? I mean, you know, Ricky Kidd, he's been in, I mean, they've been fighting, he's been fighting for about 10, 12 years or so for his freedom. Why do you think it takes so, and that's what people don't understand. It takes a while. But why do you think it takes so long?
The people who are in positions to make critical decisions turns a blind eye and a deaf ear on the truth, okay?
Okay.
They done heard the false evidence for so long, that's what they believe. When the truth come before them, they don't want to accept it, okay?
Okay.
That goes back to the cliche that, hey, I made a mistake in this case, but they would say that among themselves, but they would not say it to that person or to the public, okay? They would do more to try to cover up a mistake instead of correcting it.
Okay, okay. And I pretty much 100% know exactly what you're talking about. So with a conviction integrity unit, do you think a legitimate conviction integrity unit would make a difference?
Absolutely. Okay, you have to realize that in these cases, people's lives are at stake, okay?
Yes, I know.
And I'm saying it takes a mighty long time to get a review. And sometimes you don't get a review because there are situations where a person does not have a high IQ or does not really understand what's being said and what's being done to them. And you talk to them for so long or, you know, interrogate them for so long, they agree to whatever it takes to get out of that room, you know, from under that pressure. You interrogate them so thoroughly that they say they believe they done it when they really didn't do it, okay?
Right, right.
And so, you know, people in those positions, they feel like they have one thing in mind. You know, they say, we're seeking a conviction. And I'm saying, then they would get in front of a news conference and say, we convicted the person that did this, that, and the other. In actuality, this is not the person that actually done it, okay?
Right, right.
So I'm going to tell you that there are so many people incarcerated right now wrongfully that you would not believe it, okay? But they do not have the help. They do not have the resources. They do not have
exactly
the people that will reach out to them, because this, to fight any case, especially a murder case, it costs a lot of money, okay?
Yes, it does.
These are more than likely urban people who do not have a lot of resources.
Right, I was just getting ready to say that. So
who family don't have a lot of resources, okay? And, you know, the peoples that are able to defend them, you know, they're family people too.
Uh-huh.
So they're not going to do it for free.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I most totally do understand what you're saying. We're coming up here on the second half of the show. In the second half of the show, it's going to be a call-in show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are some people that probably have some questions for you. This is a very important topic, Mr. Griffin. I don't think people really understand exactly what all it entails of to address these issues of wrongful conviction, the finances that it takes, or, you know, it's a lot. And people just simply, I don't think they understand it. I think people kind of turn a deaf ear, you know, well, if it's not my loved one that's incarcerated, then it's,
They understand it only when it hits close to home, because they don't even think or believe that things like this actually happen until it happens to someone close to them.
Okay, you're exactly correct. Okay, well, you know what? We're going to be back on the second half of the show, and we're going to finish discussing all of these issues here.
And now for the calendar of events, and we only have one event on the calendar today. And with me to tell us about that is Esther Holzendorf. Reverend Esther, are you there?
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, listening audience.
Okay. We want you to talk a little bit about Sankofa for KC, a visit with Bobby Seale. Why don't you first off explain what Sankofa is?
Sankofa is a Twa word in the language of Ghana that means go back and get it, or go back and fetch, go back and take. It ties in with the African proverb, it is not wrong to go back and get those things that you have forgotten. So it's going back to being the best person that we can be, to be loving and kind and taking care of one another, being community, doing what Dr. King envisioned, building the beloved community.
Bobby Seale is coming here. There's been a group of folks from different churches and others that have been putting together a 10-point plan, like the Panthers did, for here and now and for the future. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what public events are going to be happening while he's here that folks can come and ask him questions and listen to him speak.
Okay, on May the 18th, which is this coming Friday, Brother Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the original Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, will be at Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, 2310 Linwood, Kansas City, Missouri, at 7 o'clock p.m. And this is open to the public. Anyone that wants to come, they can. There is no charge. And after the Bobby speaks, there will be a Q&A. So we won't have time to answer everybody's questions, but we will do the best we can to answer those that he'll deal with, the ones that he has time to deal with.
Okay.
And then on the 19th, yeah, at Brush Creek Community Center at 1 o'clock, that's 3801 Cleaver 2 Boulevard, there will be a interfaith basketball game, and that is at 1 o'clock. Then at 3 o'clock, at that same location, there will be another Q&A with Bobby Seale.
Yes, and that event on Saturday is a celebration of Malcolm X as well.
It is a celebration of Brother Malcolm X's birthday, which is May 19th. Yes, you're right.
Well, I guess the other thing is that this is an ongoing event. This is not the culmination of what we've been doing. This is just the beginning. You may want to give folks a little bit of information about the meeting the following Tuesday, where we're going to talk about and see where we go from there with the information we get from Bobby Seale.
Yes, we have, as you know, Jeff, because you're serving on the teams, at least one or two of the teams, we have identified the 10 critical areas or the 10 critical points that we want Brother Bobby Seale to help us to strategize and begin to implement. But now the implementation phase of the Sankofa Project is a continuum, because Sankofa is not just an activity, it is a movement. And so we will have an after-action meeting on the 22nd at the Rosser Simpson CME Church. That's the 29th in Indiana at 6 p.m. And so we would like for people to come to that, because we do need to have the community involved in building these teams. Now, this 10-point plan is modeled after the Black Panther plan of 50 years ago. So we'll be dealing with education, economics, gentrification, care of elders, taking care of the youth, violence, although we're breaking violence down into not just a word, but cause. We're dealing with the criminal justice system. So all of these teams are in place, but we need team members. So on the 22nd at 6 p.m., at the Rosa Simpson CME Church at 29th in Indiana. Anyone from the community can come and become a part of one of these teams.
Okay, we want to thank you very much for coming on today and giving us this information. We're going to come back to Latara and Reggie here in just a moment, and your phone calls, of course.
Well, everyone, thank you back. It's Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project, and you are listening to KKFI 90.1 FM. I have the privilege of interviewing Mr. Reggie Griffin today. Mr. Griffin actually is an individual who served approximately 31 years within the Missouri Department of Corrections for a crime that he did not commit. Though he served 31 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, he also served 10 years on death row for a crime that he did not commit. Mr. Griffin, and also the second half of this show, we are opening the line to callers. So if anyone would like to call, you have any questions, please feel free to reach out and give us a call. The number here to the station is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. And I understand that we now have a caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, hello. How are you?
Hi. I'm Nathan. I live out of Shawnee, Kansas.
Yes, Nathan. Thank you for calling in.
And I was, answer your question. One of the questions you asked, was that why a case has to go to Supreme Court before it's overturned when there's a wrongful conviction. Well, first off, let me make a little statement to my brother there. Condolences for the years you spent for unlawful incarceration. Too many of that is happening to our people.
Yes.
Everybody's undergoing that. It's not a racial issue. One thing that I want to bring to the table is individual responsibility. In other words, most people don't know the law.
Exactly.
So we hire a lawyer. You hire a lawyer, someone to defend your case. Now, that's where the rub comes, because if you don't know anything about what he's supposed to do, with how to hold his feet to the fire, then what's the point? In other words, we have to show some proactivity as far as knowing some of the law, so we understand some of the issues that's involved, jurisdiction, status, standing, and so forth. Because if we don't know, if we're leaving everything to someone who knows we don't know, I mean, people are going to be people. They're just going to take advantage, and that's unfair, but that's the way it is. Anyway, that's a system, like you said, that's a systematic thing, but we also have to be proactive.
And I
as
most
as not taught in school. Yeah, go ahead.
I totally, totally agree with you, sir. Is Nathan, is that correct?
Yes.
I totally agree with you, and I say that, I preach that all the time, that, we have to educate ourselves, because how can we know if something's not being done if we never know that it was supposed to be done? And
right.
So that is a very, very good point to make, and thank you so much for calling in and making that point, because it most definitely fits the situation. It's a good point. Thank you so much, Nathan, for calling in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And Reggie, I do agree with what Nathan just said. It is very important, because I know that you were active in studying and.
Absolutely, there's no way I would be sitting here in this chair if I was not involved in the process. Okay.
Exactly.
I don't know about everybody, but I'm gonna say that once you are confined and that fight becomes your life, so you learn everything you can and everything there is to know about that case. And I'm saying, absolutely, I was involved in the proceedings from start to finish.
Yes. So, and do you think that played a drastic part? Well, it helps you to work along with your attorney, because you have a say-so. Because, once again, people don't understand, the attorney represents you. So if there's something that you want done, or something that you want added to a motion, or if you want to make sure that something is in a motion, then you need to communicate that to your attorney. Do you agree or do you disagree?
There's not one attorney I had that would tell you that I did not have input, okay?
Okay.
I would tell them, before you send anything in, please let me look over it, okay?
Because you know what I have found looking into cases, investigating cases, individuals that had the appeal attorneys that came in, you know, and represented them in their appeal. Many times I hear the client say, I told them to say this. I told them to add this. Mm-hmm. I told my appeals attorney to put that in my claim, but they didn't. And, you know, I hear that quite a bit. And because they didn't, you know, because they didn't bring it up, it ends up being an issue later on down the line.
Well, you know, I know everybody don't really, a lot of people don't really know, but anytime you're dealing with an attorney and you have an attorney-client relationship, you don't tell them, you put it in writing.
Exactly.
Okay, and that way you have a copy and they have a copy. You can say that, well, I told him, you can say, I sent this to him and asked him to do this and asked him to do that. Here's my copy, okay?
Right.
And being that it is a legal document, it would be notarized, so.
And you know what? And I had someone that sent something to their appeals attorney and it did not get added in, okay? And the appeals attorney said, hey, I didn't receive it. So you know what I always tell people to do?
Send it certified.
Send it certified mail, sign upon receipt, or if you have a loved one out here that has access to a scanner,
mm-hmm.
you sign it, send that letter out to your loved one, let your loved one scan it, attach it to an email, and send it to your attorney.
Right.
Or let a loved one or a family member utilize a fax machine and let them fax it on the outside where they're going to have a confirmation that your attorney did indeed receive that information. I understand we have a caller on the line. Caller, yes. Are you there, caller?
Yes, this is Kurt from the East Side.
Hi, Kurt. Thank you for calling in.
You're giving a lot of well-earned, you know, information that you've got from experience. Is there some resource that you can get or that you would recommend? Or maybe, you know, I'm envisioning that everybody who gets convicted gets, you know, some information sent to him by, you know, somebody outside the legal system to say, hey, this is where you get started. This is the ins and outs of all the stuff that you're telling us now, and I'm going to forget it next week. Where can we get this information that's really useful for people that are, you know, just newly convicted or, you know, whatever?
Well, I can tell you this. In the prison, they know a lot. A lot travels as far as resources and things that's available. The guys really, and as well as the women, they most definitely have a kind of a lookout system in there. If there's some type of resource available, you know, a lot of times, from my experience and what I know, it's a lot of hearsay. Mr. Griffin, we have another caller, but real quick, you want to address that?
Well, you know, there are limited resources in that, but there are a few, okay? But if you are in a position to try to help yourself with those remedies, it's somebody there that will help you. I'm not going to say it's the best help,
right?
But it is a little help,
right.
Okay? And, you know, I'm going to say this. Being that it's your case, it's paramount that you know something about it, okay? That
right.
way you will have some input.
Right, right. And then, sir, also real quick, I want to say this. They are really good about sharing information with each other. Like we have the new organization that Daryl Burton has put together called Miracles of Innocence. And let me tell you, it's just coming together. It actually hadn't launched all the way, but I know it's getting ready to do that here within a matter of months. And I tell you, it's gone like wildfire through the Department of Corrections. So word travels. But caller, thank you so much for calling in. I understand we have another caller. Hello. Hi, Latara. Thank you for calling in. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Ms. Smith. My name is Donna Torrain.
Hi, Ms. Torrain. Thank you for calling in.
You're very welcome. I have two questions to ask. I think the first question I'd like to know is, how many people has the Innocent Project gotten out on the Missouri side?
And also, which Innocent,
what are the legal costs?
Which Go Innocent ahead, Project are you speaking of?
We have the Midwest Innocence Project. Is that the one that you're speaking about that takes care of the Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Missouri? Is that the Innocence Project that you're speaking about?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I'm going to say what timeline are you speaking on?
Within how many years? Let's say within the last 10 years. Is that fair to say, Donna? Well, that's what you
said. Yeah, 8-10 years, yeah. Just how many people in general have the Innocent Project gotten out on the Missouri side? And I think that's kind of a wide-range question. But yeah,
well, I'm going to say
go ahead.
Maybe two, maybe.
Okay, on the Missouri side, okay. Okay.
You said two?
I'm going to say maybe two, okay? Because I'm not, you know, like, I'm not 100% sure about it, but I'm going to say maybe two. But you have to look at the pros and the cons of that because, you know, like, it depends on where they took the case at, who had the case before they got involved with it. So, you know, like, they may have assisted, but somebody else may have did the footwork and the groundwork. You know, I'm going to tell you that it's a very touchy situation because one lawyer can be working on a case and you run out of funds, and if there are no more funds available, somebody else has to step in and pick it up because they want to be paid.
Right, right, right.
Yeah,
so
yeah, okay. I understand.
And what would be your second question?
Also, what are the legal costs for attorneys to help the innocent person get out?
Like, about what do they run roughly?
Yes.
You know what? That can vary. I've seen, you know, information stats on the Innocence Project's page, and it said what I think it was like $350,000 or something on average.
Or more. Okay. It depends because let me explain something to you. Okay. My case was overturned in 2012. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back to the county jail, I had a public defender and me and him did not really get along, okay?
Okay.
So I contacted my family and I told them, I said, hey, mama, I need another lawyer, okay? And being that my case was already overturned, she's from the St. Louis area. And she went out in St. Louis County.
So let's explain that because we don't want to confuse them. So when Mr. Griffin's case was overturned, mm-hmm. he had to go back to trial.
They said that they was going to retry me, so the process started over, okay?
Right, so at that point you had to have now
a trial
you need
attorney.
To have, so you went from Mr. Gibson, who actually worked to overturn the conviction,
he's an appeal lawyer.
Right, so now you needed a trial attorney.
Okay, right.
And so that's what it is. Okay.
When I called my family and I told them, I said, well, I'm in another trial process, okay? And she went out in St. Louis County and talked to a few lawyers. And my case was already overturned, right?
Right.
But they still tell her, I want $80,000 and I
no.
want. Yes, I want
really?
$80,000 and I want 40 before any proceedings start,
right,
okay?
Because see, now we're in a trial again. We're in a murder trial all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the first one's been overturned, it's been overturned, but they wanted to retry Mr. Griffin. So the process, the nightmare reoccurs, basically.
Well, you know,
so there is a legal price. Now, what about the thing of pro bono? I mean, can that happen as well?
By the grace of God, this lawyer up here in Kansas City heard about my case, and she took it pro bono. Her name is Cindy Short.
Cindy Short.
Okay.
So Mrs. Short was a private attorney here in Kansas City, and
yes,
she
ma'am.
Took your case. Kent Gibson worked to overturn it, got it overturned, and Cindy Short came in and offered you pro bono services.
Absolutely.
Wow. That is a blessing.
Wow.
Well, caller, thank you so much for calling in. We actually have another caller on the line, but thank you so much. Hi, caller, your name?
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Am I on? This is Brother Ron McMillan.
Hi, Brother McMillan.
How you doing, Tara?
I'm blessed.
I was wondering where do we actually go from here? Is it time to nationalize our efforts for those who are illegally incarcerated? Because every 2 or 3 months, I was the longest I was about 43 years in prison, which was finally overturned. 30 years, then over there in Kansas, the brother, 22 years. They just keep popping up.
Yeah.
And it's horribly difficult to get out. But we have brothers, Sundi Adekola, political prisoners, Abu Jamal. This is a long intergenerational thing. Is it time for us to try and nationalize the wrongfully incarcerated into some type of movement to look at all the cases? So we can sort of start dealing with what We got 98.6% of the prosecutors in this country are white males.
Mm-hmm.
And that picture ain't never going to change.
Well,
but they're not held accountable when they make mistakes.
Well, I can say this here.
They have a shield, okay? And believe me, they use it, okay? The prosecutor has what is called a shield. And mm-hmm. you cannot sue them. You cannot do this to them. You cannot do that to them. Even though right. you can prove that they proved that they hid evidence from me. And I'm right. saying nobody stood accountable for that, okay?
Right, right.
So how do we address that in the law? Yeah, it happens over and over again, and we don't seem to be able to get our handle on it.
You know, Mr. McMillan, I want to say
really
this.
Strong.
We do need to come together. And I hear you say nationalize, but you know what? We need to localize and come together because and then make it bigger, because we have several cases right here out of Jackson County, Missouri. You know, Keith Carnes case being one of them, where there is an extreme amount of newly discovered evidence. And our local prosecutor, Jean Peters Baker, has just absolutely fought it, you know, using jurisdictional issues. We're not going to hear it on the local level because it's a jurisdictional issue. When our prosecutor has an obligation under the ABA rule standards 3.8 to acknowledge the newly discovered evidence, investigate it, and make it known into the courts. It doesn't say fight jurisdictional issues so it can block being heard in the court. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say, well, if the witnesses are creditable, well, the witnesses are not creditable who recanted. But these witnesses were credible enough to convict Mr. Carnes. So it's not right. So, you know, here locally, you know, we just don't have the issue of Keith Carnes' case. We look at Ricky Kidd. Why did they fight Ricky Kidd's case like they did? Why does he have to go all the way up to the Supreme Court? Why does he have to go back to DeKalb County? Why was he not heard here? I mean, so until we can come together and stand up and hold Miss Jean Peters Baker accountable and say, hey, you're not following your ethical rules and standards, because it starts with Jean Peters Baker and her office. It starts there. So that's
so
who we need to look at locally.
It should be localized efforts rather than trying to nationalize it or go wide. But
most
stay
definitely
with the cases that we can win here locally.
And then use those as an example. And move forward and say, look, this is why come the Casey Freedom Project. Why come four and a half years ago, we pushed. My push was for a conviction integrity unit, because I know that there are men and women that are in prison who cannot afford to pay for these appellate post-conviction relief attorneys. So because they can't, you know, because they're, you know, dealing, you know, with these horrible finances and poverty, they're being kept in prison because of that. When if we had a legitimate conviction integrity unit that can look at this newly discovered evidence, investigate it, make it known to the courts, challenge the integrity of the conviction, and get them people back in court, then we would have a system like in Dallas, Texas, when Craig Watkins started the conviction integrity unit. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have several people free in Texas. You understand? They would, because they could not afford to pay for that type of representation. You know, so there's organizations like, we do have the Midwest Innocence Project, and they do a great work. We have now the Miracles of Innocence organization. It's not a project. It's an organization that Daryl Burton has founded. And Mr. Burton also has was innocent, wrongly convicted, and served, 20-something years?
27 years.
27 years within,
27.
The Missouri Department of Corrections. And so, you know, he sees the need. He's been through the struggle. He knows what's going on. And so now he's put together his organization. But, you know, it starts with these prosecutors. It starts with these prosecutors being held accountable. You know, all of this prosecutorial overcharging, like what they're doing in the Cameron Gines case. Charging Mr. Gines, you know, with second-degree murder when it was actually a self-defense case, you know? Why do we have to get him on down the line and then address these issues and come back? And, you know, why send this young man to prison for second-degree murder when we can address it?
Life.
He was defending his life. Why wait till evidence comes out later, you know, and then say, okay, we're going to bring him back in and redo it? It takes years to get back in front of a judge. We all know that.
Well, if we're to organize community efforts, what focal point? Should we be going at, what can we do to a prosecutor who has missed, overcharged, and it's just, do they have to have repeated cases before we can indict them? What should be the community's?
Well, I tell you what, Mr. McMillan, I'm going to contact you. I do have your contact information, and we'll pick up this question because we're actually running out of time on the show.
Oh, okay,
but I will contact you, and we'll pick it up from here, okay?
Well, congratulations to you on your great work. And
thank you.
We need to know how to support. As a matter of fact, I said you should be institutionalized.
Thank you so much, Mr. McMillan.
More people can begin to get educated.
Thank you
and
so
know
much.
How to fight this. So
thank
God
you.
God bless you.
Thank
Peace.
You. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning into the show. We've run out of time. Mr. Griffin, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone, have a blessed and wonderful day.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
I'm Beth Curtis, and I have the website Life for Pot, and I advocate for sentencing relief for marijuana in May 2000. We were serving sentences of life without parole. I have a brother who fits that category and has been incarcerated for 22 years. It's a first-time nonviolent marijuana offender.
Beth, you know, your brother is certainly not alone in being treated, I would say, unfairly, overzealous judges and district attorneys, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is Americans have been sentenced to millions and millions of years behind bars for possession of this plant. Am I correct?
You're correct. My brother is not alone, and that's why I started Life for Pot and tried to spotlight specific and random marijuana offenders who had life without parole and also de facto life sentences. But every year, hundreds of thousands of people are arrested for marijuana offenses. That doesn't mean that they're charged, but I think last year over... I think 500,000 were arrested for marijuana, and it's been as high as over 800,000. That's kind of a travesty. I mean, when you think about marijuana being legalized to various degrees in state after state, and yet we are still incarcerating people, giving them huge sentences for the same product, there's a disconnect. Well, in 1994, my brother was indicted in the Northern District of Florida, which was a place he'd never been, never worked. As it turned out, there was ex-law enforcement officer in Florida who was a fugitive on cocaine charges. And he wanted to make some kind of a deal. And he was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he was trying to buy a boat from an attorney there, and he was spending time in the attorney's office, and he decided that he thought that the attorney and his associate had been involved in the marijuana industry at some point. So he went back to the Florida prosecutors, or had his attorney go, and ask if he could get them to come to Florida for a sting operation with a...
Part 2 on tomorrow's report. I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.